Lecture 34, Christianization and Economic Change.
In this lecture, I plan to look at two related issues, that is, the Christianizing of society, by which I mean the acceptance of Christian religious and ethical values, and the transformation of the public life and the public worship into a distinctly and noticeably Christian form, as opposed to just accepting Christ as a God, perhaps as a God among many gods. And the second issue is economic change and progress in Scandinavia from 1100 to maybe 1350. And on first look, there might be a bit of curiosity how these two seemingly different issues are really part of the same story. And what I plan to do with both these issues is to show how the development of a distinctly Christian society and all of the economic improvements and changes that came as a result of accepting Christianity, as a result of establishing Christian monarchies, transformed Scandinavia from a Viking into a distinctly Christian European world. And so I take the year 1100 as our starting point because it is at this point that these forces really come into play. And by 1350, there is absolutely no question, that is just at about the time of the Black Death, that Scandinavia is now part of that wider Latin Christendom. And these changes, perhaps more than any specific political or military event, determine far more the end of the Viking Age. And we'll see that in several important areas. But just to note that it changed the ethos, the martial ethos that had motivated Vikings from the 9th through the 11th century. It also changed the economic underpinnings of Scandinavian society. So going overseas to fight as Vikings, the types of colonization activities we saw in the 10th and 11th century were no longer necessary. And those two factors together changed the Scandinavians significantly enough that there would never again be a Viking Age. So 1100 is a very good point to take as marking this change. So let's look at our first topic, and that is the Christianizing of Scandinavian society. This was already going on in the 10th and 11th century, but it really picks up force after 1100. And it's seen in the establishment of bishoprics and of parish churches, first in Denmark and then later in Norway and in Sweden. And it is difficult to exaggerate the importance of setting up this type of institutional Christianity. King Canute, who ruled in England and also ruled in Denmark, really began the process in Denmark. He established what became eventually the great eight bishoprics of Denmark. And this required the establishment of a town as a diocese, that is, as the center of a bishop, the construction of a cathedral church, the endowment of lands to support that church. That meant the imposition of tithes, the taxing of 10% of the dues of the congregation to support religious activities, and that would include maintaining the clergy, undertaking alms, various other expenses that would come up. And between, say, 1025 and 1100, those towns such as Viborg, Aarhus, Ribe, Odense, Lund, which is now in southern Sweden, all of these towns, Roskilde is another one, all of these towns begin to assume really the trappings of a European-style town in the late 11th and early 12th century. The churches generated business. The business of religion, that is, the need to have a literate staff, the need to contract with builders to put up churches, to be sure, originally constructed in wood, not in stone, vastly transformed the type of economic activities that you would have seen in Denmark during the Viking Age. And so as the bishoprics are then established in Norway and in Sweden, the same changes accompany them. In 1104, Lund is designated as the Archbishopric of Denmark. It is granted by the Pope, the then reigning Pope Paschal II, elevates Lund, and so the Danish monarchy now has, in effect, its own national church. This occurs a generation later in both Norway and Sweden. At Nidaros in 1153, Primate of Norway is established there, and later in 1164 at Uppsala, in Sweden. And once you have a primate, that is, you have an archbishop for your kingdom who represents the leading figure of all the bishoprics, and he answers to Rome. That archbishop and those bishops, it's important to remember, are closely associated with the nobility and the king, because the types of Christian institutions coming in are those that had been forged in the Carolingian age. And I stressed this in an earlier lecture dealing with Charlemagne and the nature of the Carolingian state, and that is the high clergy, the prelates, the men who come to rule the institutions of the church are very much the same men who are the nobility who serve the court. And it's important to remember that bishops and kings who forged that alliance back in the 11th century between sea kings and very often bishops without portfolio, that is bishops who were either English or Germans who traveled with the king, those bishops are now native Scandinavian nobility endowed with a great bishopric and operating in tandem with the king. The best example we have of that comes from Denmark in the 12th century under the reign of King Valdemar. Valdemar I of Denmark, Valdemar the Great, who ruled from 1157 to 1182, had as his bishop of Roskilde his cousin Absalon. And he and Absalon had been reared together in the same household. They were the best of friends. And Absalon was later, in 1178, consecrated Archbishop of Lund. He was the third Archbishop of Lund. And Absalon and Valdemar together worked as a team. They operated in tandem in pushing the crusade against the Wends, that is, the Slavs on the southern littoral of the Baltic. And some Danish writers, such as Saxo Grammaticus, thought of Absalon more as a Viking sea king than a real bishop. They also worked together in pushing the development of law, both religious law dealing with religious institutions and the extension of royal justice. And then when King Valdemar died, Absalon acted as the chief minister for Valdemar's two sons. That would be Canute VI and Valdemar II. And it was Absalon who really worked out a lot of the details of Danish alliances with the Hohenstaufen family in Germany. And so from the start, the creation of these bishoprics and archbishoprics had very, very important consequences for turning these monarchies in Denmark and in Norway into really effective monarchies. It was not nearly as successful in Sweden because of the restrictions on the monarchy I discussed in a previous lecture. Now, besides those political institutions, that is, the church and the monarchy now come together and rule these territorial states. The creation of bishoprics and below them parish churches profoundly changed the spiritual and ethical outlook of Scandinavians. And this is a process that went on through the 12th and 13th and 14th centuries, and it is debated among scholars exactly when do the Scandinavians really become Christians in a meaningful sense. Well, it's perhaps sooner than most would like to believe, and not quite as quickly as some would want to believe. There are some ways of testing how this took place. There has been some extremely clever work done in art history from two lines of investigation. One is just looking at burial practices. Shortly after 1100, at least in Denmark and Norway, Sweden again is a little bit later, the practice of raising great barrows or putting grave goods with the deceased essentially ceases. And burial practices shift over to what are regarded as far more typical memorials associated with Christians. That can also be documented in Iceland during the 11th century, after the act of conversion in 1000. By 1100, the Icelanders are essentially burying their dead, as all Christians would. And the same is true in Denmark and Norway, and eventually in Sweden as well. Another way at testing how much Christian values enter into the consciousness of Scandinavians is looking at the paintings and relief sculpture that are dedicated by donors in the early Romanesque churches, notably in Denmark and Norway. And these would be panels that are given by usually a couple as an act of piety to the parish church, and they depict various scenes of spirituality. And starting in the 11th, really starting after 1100, it's really from the opening of the 12th century, these become very, very common. And there are enough of them around. And again, you're dealing with the middle and upper levels of society. You're not dealing with the peasants necessarily. But nonetheless, the extent of these paintings and dedications indicate that certainly in Norway and Denmark after 1100, no one believed in Valhalla anymore, that the Christian conceptions of hell and heaven had been accepted. And above all, church decorations in Norway, especially on these early wooden stave churches, indicate that the old heroes were perfectly okay to add as decorations. The heroes of the Volsungs, for instance, Sigurd slaying Fafnir. But the old gods, usually you stayed away from those decorations. Many Scandinavians after 1100 came to regard them as demons, the goddesses as witches. It's all sort of sorcery. And those, whatever beliefs they had had in the Asir and the Vanir, that is, the gods of Asgard and the gods of prosperity, had essentially passed away in the early 12th century, never to return. Well, maybe not quite never to return. Apparently, sometime in early 2004, the Danish government officially recognized that 1,000 of its citizens are now designated a religion in Denmark because they worship the ancestral gods, the Asar, that is the gods of Snorri Sturluson. There's no continuity between this group and the Vikings, and one shudders to think they're probably descendants of 19th century romantic visions of the Scandinavian gods. And I think their main reason for pushing it, you know, I can only surmise their motives. Their main reason for pushing this status is to get tax-exempt status. So there's at least 1,000 people in Denmark right now invoking Odin. But overall, the society has become Christian and has been Christian probably since at least 1100. Furthermore, in a country such as Denmark, the number of parish churches multiply across the landscape in the 12th century, and certainly by 1200. No Danish peasant is more than a short walk from a parish church. Regular attendance of services is very easy. Denmark gets converted into a society of villages and peasants. Norway and Sweden, especially in the northern sections of Norway, their parish churches may be away from your isolated farmstead by as much as a week. You have over 2,000 parish churches documented in Denmark in the 13th century, maybe, you know, less than half that number in Norway, maybe 1,200. It's harder to get to services in Norway and part of Sweden than it is in Denmark, but it can be done. And certainly attending all high holidays is more than easy to do. And that is extremely important, because the attendance of those church services get connected with baptisms, with marriage, with death, funerary rites. And these replace the old gods so that Christianity becomes closely embedded in the social values and daily life of Scandinavians. And this is clearly well established before the outbreak of the Black Death in the mid-14th century. Scandinavia becomes a Christian land, or all of Scandinavian kingdoms become Christian lands. Furthermore, the clergy in Scandinavia, starting in the 13th century, and some of the nobility, that is, the men who will serve as secular lords to the king, increasingly acquire a European identity. They start attending universities in Europe, notably Paris and Bologna in the 13th century, and starting in the 14th century in the German-speaking university, particularly Heidelberg, which is the second German-speaking university to be established in the 14th century. And that intellectual connection with Heidelberg and related German universities in the 14th and 15th centuries is one of the reasons why the Scandinavians are very inclined to listen to Luther and the Reformation. They come out of a lot of the same intellectual tradition. Some scholars have gone so far as to argue that the type of pietism, or the piety, you know, pietism is extreme piety, however you want to term is a little bit loaded, but the type of Christianity that comes to pervade in Scandinavia in the High Middle Ages is one that is really very conservative in nature. It stresses very much traditional Christian values. It is not particularly linked to monastic and ascetic traditions. It's very much tied to the bishops and the monarchy, and the rather conservative nature of Scandinavian Christianity in some ways inclined Scandinavians to listen to the appeals of Luther in the time of the Reformation. And there is very little evidence, in my opinion, there's really no evidence to argue that the Scandinavians carried over some sort of traditional values from the Viking Age, and so the Reformation represented a break from this Catholic Roman tradition and the reassertion of a Scandinavian Germanic tradition. Far from it. The Scandinavians who followed Luther did it for very, very good Christian theological grounds, justification by faith alone, and all of those values of the Reformation struck a very powerful chord, and there was always a close association between the bishops and the kings who together decided to carry out the Reformation in Denmark and Sweden. Maybe not so much in Norway. In Norway, the Reformation was more imposed rather than accepted by the Danish monarchy. So in any sense, in every sense of the word, the Scandinavian kingdoms become Christian lands. And that is one of the biggest changes why there's no more Viking Age. You do not go out and raid fellow Christians. You cannot engage in one of the most lucrative activities of the Viking Age, that is the slave trade. And as a result, Scandinavian kings, bishops, and nobles intermarry with their counterparts in the rest of Europe. They attend European-style universities. European literature is being translated into Scandinavians, hence the proliferation of all of those translations that we have in Iceland from the 13th and 14th century of Arthurian legend, romance, the romances of Alexander the Great. And there is no chance of the Scandinavians ever going back to that notion of the Viking Age once they've become members of that European community. Well, there's another powerful force that's shaping these changes, and this is to be associated with the economic and, as a result, social and other changes following the establishment of Christian kingdoms and the emergence of a Christian society. By converting to Christianity, by forging closer links with Western Europe, the Scandinavians gained a great deal of practical advantages. As the Viking Age passes and attacks and raids are essentially completely supplanted by trade, the Scandinavians now get immediate access to the technical and managerial advances in European agriculture that had been going on since the 10th century. For one, Scandinavians for the first time acquire what are known as the Coulter plows. These are plows devised in the Frankish world. It's still debated when this took place, but certainly they are being used widely in the 10th and 11th centuries. And these are heavy plows pulled by horses, the powerful workhorses of Northern Europe, equipped with a horse collar plow rather than using the old ox system. And these plows can cut deep into the rich, dense, moist soils of Northern Europe. The arrival of the Coulter plow and associated equipment meant you could not only dig into the soil, you could cut it and turn it over into the classic furrows that allow for the type of agriculture that characterizes manorial farming in Western feudal Europe, or to be more accurate, manorial Europe. That is, plowing in long strips. With the use of horses and Coulter plows, you can plow much more efficiently, much more quickly. That allows for peasants to live in villages and walk to their fields rather than to live in scattered settlements. With the plows come millstones and water mills, windmills, all sorts of devices that allow for more rapid thrashing and grinding of flour. And these improvements promote the development of what we call classic manorial agriculture. That is, a landlord, secular or ecclesiastical, or even royal, organizing deals with his peasants whereby they farm grains and they're engaged in stock raising and they pay dues to the lord in return for working the land. There are labor services involved. These are the classic manorial arrangements. And of course, this system is an efficient system of using agriculture. That's why it developed in Western Europe. And this system is brought in especially to the Danish kingdom. That is the Danish medieval kingdom, including southern Sweden. And between 1100 and 1250, the Danish landscape is dramatically transformed. These are the first major improvements in agriculture since the early Iron Age. The forests are cleared substantially. And today, when you go to Scandinavia, especially in Denmark, you're looking at essentially managed parks. You turn Denmark into a land of villages, a land of wheat and barley fields, and these villages are populated by peasants who owe labor and various kind services. Later, they're commuted into actually cash payments to their landlords. You have the classic peasant society of Western Europe. And as a result, prosperity rises. This type of agriculture produces far more surplus. The Danes already in the 13th century begin to diversify their economies and respond to conditions in Germany and Central Europe, which are also improving with the development of town life and the improvements of agriculture in what are going to become Germany and Poland. And the Danes figure out that they have a comparative advantage. They start exporting, especially pork, dairy products, which they can raise under these manorial systems, and in turn import wheat. And the Danes in the 11th, 12th century, the diet and the prosperity of Danish peasants and burghers, that is, merchant classes in the towns and villages, improves dramatically. And that is a result of bringing in all of this manorial farming, the management of the so-called three-field system. And by anyone's guess, in Denmark, the figures are quite dramatic. Denmark's population more than doubles between 1100 and 1250. You don't have to export that population as Vikings anymore. Those people can be fed in Denmark. And furthermore, substantial amount of surpluses are being made that Danish landlords can market these in the towns of the Rhineland, the lowlands, central Germany. And those economic connections reinforce the intellectual and university connections I spoke of with the Christianizing of society. The pattern in Norway and Sweden is different. Whereas Denmark, by probably 1350, and we're projecting these figures back from figures of, say, 1500, Denmark by 1350, 75% of the land is in the hands of landlords who are exacting labor services from their peasants. And maybe anywhere from, it's a matter of debate, 15% or more of the land is actually royal land. In Norway and in Sweden, the pattern is different. In Norway, perhaps a third of the land remains in the hands of small landowners. In Sweden, at least 50% or more. In Norway, you get some of that pattern in the areas around the Viken. But in most of Norway, you still have dependence on fishing and hunting, and above all, the development of commercial fishing. So many Norwegians are able to maintain a certain amount of independence from landlords and to prosper from all of these technical advantages coming in from Western Europe. In Sweden, the case is even more dramatic. Sweden, as I said, is potentially a very wealthy country. One of the areas where the Swedes begin to take off, starting in the 13th century, is in mining activities. With the end of the Viking Age and the development of trades, the Swedes begin to exploit their copper and iron deposit. And that's one of the reasons why Stockholm emerges. Stockholm is very, very close to the mining districts, and the mining districts become one of the most important features of the Swedish economy, diversifying it and fueling it. Stockholm is a deep water port. All of that ore can be exported into the German world. Imports can be brought in by members of the Hanseatic League. And as a result, the Swedish mining activities really generate prosperity, the development of towns, and eventually of cities. Agriculture is also far more diverse in Sweden. There's enormous timber resources that are part of the export trade. The arable is slowly and steadily expanded. And the Swedes have, by 1350, at the time of the Black Death, by far the most diversified economy in Scandinavia, with mining, lumbering activities, traditional Arctic products, a far more diversified agricultural economy. It still does not have as much population as Denmark, but it's on the rise, and the future really does rest economically with Sweden. And just as in Norway and Denmark, these changes also vitiate the need to have Viking raids. I mean, you don't need this when you can support your people at home and you're making such substantial profits. Well, the changes in agriculture, the development of the timber industry, the development of mining, all of this is assisted by the development of trade and towns, and eventually from towns to cities. In part, the changes in agriculture are responding to the demand being generated by raising towns that have been brought on by the development of church institutions, the creation of royal capitals, and the need to market products overseas as great commercial ventures. These include the export of dairy products and especially ham and pork from Denmark, and above all, commercial fishing enterprises. Again, with the emergence of towns and the establishment of prosperity and trade, not only in Denmark, but all of Northern Europe, commercial fishing on a major scale becomes an extremely profitable venture. Norwegians engage in the fishing of cod. The Danes in that narrow strait, the Sund between Skane and Zealand, are right on the herring grounds. Herring and cod becomes a major staple in the European diet, and the Danish and Norwegian fishermen are in a position to exploit it. A town such as Bergen, which is a deep water port, a bishopric in Norway, Lund in southern Sweden, that is the Archbishopric of Denmark, emerge as great centers for the processing and distribution of fish destined for European markets. Herring out of Lund, cod coming out of Bergen. Both of these export trades are feeding the towns of Germany and the Low Countries, and in return, various products are being imported to pay for this, and the quality of life rises, both in Norway and Denmark as a result, and changes attitudes and mores of these people. There is also another development which, in the long run, does not prove so, shall we say, so friendly or beneficial to at least the Scandinavian monarchs. And that is increasingly the emergence of towns and cities which provide these markets that fuel economic change, that the trade, the carrying trade, the actual moving of products, increasingly falls out of the hands of Scandinavians into the hands of Germans. And that is the one feature in economic and social change in this period that has major implications and explains, you know, very well why there's no resumption of a Viking Age. And at first look at it, it's rather curious that the Scandinavians, who had dominated European shipping and shipbuilding for over 350 years, by the middle of the 12th century, from maybe the 1150s, 1170s on, slowly begin to lose their lead to the Germans and to the Dutch. Foremost, the city of Lübeck on the Baltic Sea, which was established as a major German port. And there are several reasons for this. First, as Scandinavia develops economically and its population rises in the period 1100 to 1350, the Scandinavian doubling of its population is small by comparison to the expansion of the population in Germany. In the lowlands in Germany, the economic developments essentially explode. There are far many more people in Germany, and the Germans are eager to colonize the eastern lands that are thinly settled. Those include the regions of the future Kingdom of Prussia in later European history, that is East Germany, and especially the southern and eastern shores along the Baltic, Lübeck, and the military monastic orders known as the Livonian Brothers of the Sword and the Teutonic Knights carry out crusading and colonizing activities, sometimes in alliance with the Danish kings, sometimes in opposition. But what happens in the course of the 13th and 14th century is the Baltic is turned into essentially a German sea. The Germans come to dominate the towns that are established, the new towns established on the southern and eastern shores. They gain economic privileges at Lund, at Copenhagen, at Stockholm, in all the major towns in Norway. And the reason is, as city-states, without the obligations to maintain armies and other problems that kings face, they are able to concentrate their efforts on shipbuilding and trade. And what happens is, by 1300, the Hanseatic League, which is an association of two German consortia, one in the north on the Baltic with Lübeck, the other Cologne in the Rhineland, they can come to dominate the carrying trade, the shipbuilding. They also come to dominate the banking, because they're handling the export of all that commercial fishing into Europe. They are bringing in the products. They also have the hard cash to advance to Scandinavian kings who are perpetually broke. And by 1300, increasingly, the Germans are taking over the banking, the financial, and the economic life of Scandinavia. Now, there are differences. Denmark, by far, falls under German economic control. Norway is not as easily affected because large parts of Norway are still beyond some of these changes. But Bergen, 25% of the merchant class in Bergen is German by the end of the 13th century. Sweden is the least effective. Sweden has the most diversified economy. It has the mining. It has a lot more different agricultural and timber products. But nonetheless, the benefit of all these changes, the transformation of the Scandinavians into Europeans, also results very much in the economic and financial integration of Scandinavia into a wider German world. And that will have major implications why the Christian kings of Scandinavia cannot capitalize on this economic development and cannot turn that old Viking warrior ethos into effective means of making Christian kingdoms in Scandinavia the arbiters of the North.